dated June 6th, 2018.
Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask that question a little differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are slightly different. Facebook gave device makers deep access to data on users and friends. Facebook struck agreements allowing phone and other device manufacturers access to vast amounts of its users' personal information. Facebook had reached data sharing partnership with at least 60 device makers, including Apple, Amazon, BlackBerry, Microsoft, and Samsung over the last 10 years, starting before Facebook apps were widely available on smartphones. The company officials said that the deals allow Facebook to expand its reach and let device makers offer customers popular features of the social network such as messaging, like buttons, and address books. But the partnerships, whose scope has not previously been reported, raise concerns about the company's privacy protections and compliance with a 2011 consent decree with the FTC. Facebook allowed the device companies access to the data of users' friends without their explicit consent, even after declaring they will no longer share such information. Facebook's leaders said that the kind of access exploited by Cambridge Analytica in 2014 was cut off by the next year when Facebook prohibited developers from collecting information from users' friends. But the company officials did not disclose that Facebook had exempted the makers of cell phones, tablets, and other hardware from such restrictions. The New York Times found device makers could retrieve personal information even from users' friends who believed they had barred them from any sharing at all. Most of the partnerships remain in effect, though Facebook began winding them down this April. The company came under intensifying scrutiny by lawmakers and regulators after news reports in March that a political consulting firm, Cambridge Analytica, misused the private information of tens of millions of Facebook users. In the furor that followed, Facebook leaders said that that kind of access exploited by Cambridge in 2014 was cut off by the next year when Facebook prohibited developers from collecting information from users' friends. But the company did not disclose that Facebook had exempted the makers of cell phone, tablets, and other hardware from such restrictions. But the problem is that as more and more data is collected on the device, and if it can be accessed by apps on the device, it creates serious privacy and security risk. They said its partnerships was governed by contracts that strictly limited the use of the data, including any stored on partner servers. The officials added that they knew of no cases where the information had been misused. Facebook officials defended the data sharing as consistent with its privacy policies, the FTC agreement, and pledges to users. The company views its device partners as extensions of Facebook, serving its more than 2 billion users. Some device partners can retrieve Facebook users' relationship status, religious and political leanings, and upcoming events, among other data. Tests by the New York Times show that the partner requested and received data in the same way other third parties did. The New York Times reported that partnership gives some device makers access to face makers' users' education, history, relationship, status, work, religion, political leanings, and upcoming events. Facebook said it forged partnerships with around these companies back when mobile phones were less powerful and app stores did not yet exist. The social media company said it gave device makers access to software only so they can build versions of Facebook that worked on different phones or operating systems. These partners signed agreements that prevented Facebook's information from being used for any other purpose other than to recreate a Facebook-like experience. They said they were not aware of any abuse by any of the companies, noting that Facebook has been winding down such access to the software. The New York Times reported that Facebook also gave device makers access to the data of users' friends without their explicit consent, even after declaring it would no longer share such information with outsiders. Facebook disputed that finding, saying that friends' information, like photos, were only accessible on devices when people made a decision to share their information with those friends. But the revelation drew quick criticism and concern. It's worrisome that so many companies had access to this data, particularly in light of security and privacy concerns. And it's hugely possible that other apps on some devices could have been mining this data if the privacy and security controls were lax.
Hey, Joe, it's unbelievable how Facebook can say one thing and have you believe it, and they do something different.
Well, you know, Hank, this one thing you didn't mention, which maybe is an important point to remember. Back in February, I know it was a long time ago, and we Americans have very short attention spans. But back in February, the CIA, the FBI, and the DIA got together. These are our top intelligence agencies, and said it would be more better if Americans did not use the Huawei product, that Huawei being a major phone manufacturing company of China, and being one of the partners, I use the word advisedly, of Facebook. Now, Facebook, of course, said nobody would use the information in a bad way, and of course, there's no reason to believe the FBI, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Establishment. Our president doesn't believe them, so why should we? But you know, somehow, I don't think Facebook took that into consideration.
Well, you know, I had just gotten a piece of email last week from Facebook, and what it was a actually, this was related to GDPR, which is the General Data Privacy Regulation that the European Union put out. And what they're basically saying is, this is our full data policy. It consists of 9 sections, and the 9 sections is very detailed, and it goes into multiple pages. And they said, you know what, this is good. This is for your good. Please consent to it. And I took the time out to read it in detail. And I, you know, for the time that we have tonight, there's 2 points I'd like to bring to everyone's attention. One is, what kind of information do they collect? You'll be shocked. And then they even come out and tell you how they plan on using the information. And, of course, it's always to benefit you, the subscriber, you, the user. And this is for your benefit.
Their explanation was a complete obfuscation of the truth. Yes, the truth was buried there, but they would not like you to know what the truth was. They really buried it.
Oh, it's I'm amazed that, by the way, they're truthful in that they tell you what they're collecting with a smile, but they're telling you that it's for your good. And I'm reading some of this stuff, and I'm saying, wait a minute. Like, for instance, networks and connections. They collect information on the pages you look at, the accounts, hashtags, groups you're connected to, how you interact with the products, and who you communicate with, who you're synced up with, all your uploads, all your downloads, every member in your address book, the call log. Hey, wait a minute. I didn't sign up for this.
They go. Hank, I get so upset. I read that as well as you, and I got so upset, and I am still so upset that it's really hard for me to talk about it. But let me give you an example. If, for example, you have done a lot of World Wide Web research on cancer, they will make the assumption that you or somebody you love has cancer, and they will put cancer ads, anti-cancer ads, cancer medicine ads, cancer center ads in your way, so you can, they're benefiting you by knowing that you've had cancer. Now, the other thing might be that they're also selling that information to the insurance companies.
Wait, Joe, let me tell you something, okay? In terms of information, they say that they don't sell information. They make it available to the advertisers so that the advertisers can help you have a better experience. If you think it's a better experience that just saying, it's nothing wrong with it, okay? I know that, you know, and the thing is that they also make the contents of your messages, in other words, in your email, they say they don't do anything with the messages, but the phone companies have the context, not only the context, but the actual messages themselves. And he said, well, the experience is so that they can see what's on your mind so they can design a better product to meet your needs. And you say to yourself, I don't need it. Now, if you try to opt out of it, I will, well, later I'll talk about it, okay? Opting out is very difficult because they mislead you into what you think the terms and conditions are by and what they and how they do it is that they tell you that there's notification for you of a message from your friend. Of course, well, you know, if someone is contacting you, your friend, you want to go see what it is. It's not what you think it is. It's basically it's for you to accept not the message from your friend, but that you accept the terms and conditions. Joe, I don't know what to say about that.
What you can say is you can ask me, what did I do after I read all of that? And what I did was I disconnected myself from Facebook. I've canceled the account. They've told me it will take up to 3 months to delete all the information, but little by little they will delete the information they have about me. They didn't say what they would do with the information they have about my friends, but I'm assuming they'll keep that. Hank, I can't tell you how. You and I have often said that if you don't pay for the service, then you yourself are the product. I didn't realize how bad it was.
Well, you know, when Mark Zuckerberg was in testifying in April before the Senate, he's talking about how Facebook is promoting democracy, how Facebook is providing freedom and so on. And many of his, many, I would say almost all of the major backers or, you know, the people holding the hedge funds, okay, and they hold. Now, this, I don't know if you're aware of this, and it should be made illegal, okay? The hedge funds own more than 50% of the stock, except the stock is broken up into two forms. One stock is you get to vote one share for every one share of stock you have. However, when they did the IPO, Mark Zuckerberg has special stock where each stock share is worth 10 votes. So
Hank,
although he has less than half...
Hank,
yes.
Hank, that's not unusual.
You know what? The SEC should not allow that.
Non-voting stock, and very often the public has got the non-voting stock. The owners, the originators of the company keep the voting stock. This is common, and it doesn't really bother me. What bothers me is the way they not only use the information they get, but they get it in a very underhanded way. I don't expect my texts and my emails to be scanned to improve the quality of the advertising that is sent to me. That's what he claims.
Well, you know, most people do not realize that when they put the photographs up, that the it's digital information. It's not like the old days where you put up a film picture where everything is in analog format. And people do not realize that when you take a digital picture, especially with today's cameras, it identifies the date, the time, the camera, the lens opening, the shutter speed. But it also identifies where you took the picture. So if you're taking a picture of a kid and, you know, that shows up on the Internet, it's an open field for pedophiles.
Well, years ago, you and I discussed the fact that among the megadata that's in the back of the picture is where it was taken on the date it was taken, which gave home thieves, burglars, a wonderful opportunity to go in and steal things from people who are on vacation or out of town. The other thing that bothers me about the pictures, I've only known one instance of it happening, but it did happen in one instance, where somebody's picture was used to sell a product they didn't particularly like. They weren't paid to use their picture. The picture was not owned by them anymore. The picture was now owned by the social media. Read the fine print.
Well, Joe, let me ask a simple question. Is there an alternative to Facebook?
Yes, there certainly is. It's called email.
You mean good old-fashioned email or even snail mail?
Well, snail mail is to be preferred. Email, if you use something like Phil Zimmerman's program to encrypt it, Phil Zimmerman being the author of PGP. The problem is that we came up through the ranks of the early days where we really believed in the honesty, the innate honesty of the people on the web, on the World Wide Web. We believed that our email was sacrosanct, just the way our first-class mail was. We believed that just as the government required a warrant to tap into our phones, we thought our data on the Internet was safe. None of those things were true. Nobody ever told us they were true, but we believed that. I have no idea why we were all so naive.
Well, you know, when you say email, you think Google's any different from Facebook?
In what way?
If you use Gmail.
No, that's what I just said. If you're going to use email of any kind, you want to encrypt it on both ends.
You got to be careful about encryption because when you say encrypt,
have you heard of PGP?
You know, like say you go through a multipath, okay? You got to be careful who your ISP is because during the process, some of the data can be exposed.
Hank, not if you use PGP. You have to use a third-party encryption. There are others besides PGP. That's the one I use. But you have to go through a third-party encryption program to be sure that your data is as safe as it is in first-class mail. Now, of course, the government has the right to intercept first-class mail if they have a warrant issued by a court.
Joe, it sounds very nice the way you say it, but in practice, if I sent, I get a lot of email, and you get a lot of email, and if you have to go through this encryption and decryption, you think you're going to read the mail?
There's going to be a lot less spam sent.
Oh, you mean the stuff I send you, you would take the time to read what I wrote?
Well, if you sent it to me, I would have your private key, and it would automatically, at my end, be decrypted. I wouldn't have to do a damn thing about it. The other thing you can do is you can use Tor. T-O-R stands for the Onion Router, and it's a very good system, and a lot of it is automated. You don't have to think about doing it. It does it for you. All I'm saying is instead of taking it for granted that leaving the front door and the back door and all the windows unlocked and trusting that your neighbors wouldn't possibly want to rob you, I suggest that you not only lock everything but get a company like ADT to monitor your locks.
Joe, I'm going to make a recommendation to our listeners. There's two things that I would like them to do. Do a search with the following keywords: Facebook full data policy. And that will take you to the location where you could see their policy. It's pages and pages. Take the time to read it. Now, there's another.
Give us that search term again.
Okay, I'm going to give you three, four words that you search on. Facebook full data policy. Okay? Another one that you should do a search on is the number 98, the numerically 98, personal data points Facebook. Now, the reason why I say that is because when in reading the policy, they refer to 98 different data points that they collect on you It is unbelievable what they collect on you. And at a Senate hearing, it was revealed that the average subscriber on Facebook, they have about 26,000 data points. In other words, 26,000 items on each user. That is like, it's probably more information than I can remember about myself.
I'd like to put it on a different basis also, Hank. The federal government trying to protect the rights of job hunters and employees in general have set certain rules about what corporations are allowed to ask. For example, they can't ask if you're married. They can't ask what your previous salary was. They can't ask what your religion is.
Okay, Joe, you got me convinced. By the way, we're going to follow with the rest of the show. We're going to talk about what Facebook is also doing, how they do, how they mislead you and other things. And I think that we're asking everyone, listen to what we have to say and just keep in, you know, when you're done with all this, you're going to opt out and say, I don't want to be on Facebook anymore. And I hope that's what you, that's a conclusion you get to. So let's get to it.
The following is an excerpt of an exchange between Senator Lujan from New Mexico with Mark Zuckerberg about users who are not Facebook subscribers.
Facebook has detailed profiles on people who have never signed up for Facebook, yes or no?
Congressman, in general, we collect data of people who have not signed up for Facebook for security purposes to prevent the kind of scraping that you were just referring to.
So these are called shadow profiles? Is that what they've been referred to by some?
Congressman, I'm not familiar with that.
I'll refer to them as shadow profiles for today's hearing. On average, how many data points does Facebook have on each Facebook user?
I do not know off the top of my head.
So the average for non-Facebook platforms is 1,500. It's been reported that Facebook has as many as 29,000 data points for an average Facebook user. Do you know how many points of data that Facebook has on the average non-Facebook user?
Congressman, I do not off the top of my head, but I can have our team get back to you afterwards.
I appreciate that. It's been admitted by Facebook that you do collect data points on non-average users. So my question is, can someone who does not have a Facebook account opt out of Facebook's involuntary data collection?
Congressman, anyone can turn off and opt out of any data collection for ads, whether they use our services or not. But in order to prevent people from scraping public information, which again, the search feature that you brought up only showed public information, people's names and profiles and things that they'd made public, but nonetheless, we don't want people aggregating even public information.
But
so we need to know when someone is trying to repeatedly access our services.
If I may, Mr. Zuckerberg, I'm about out of time. It may surprise you that we've not talked about this a lot today. You said everyone controls their data, but you're collecting data on people that are not even Facebook users, that have never signed a consent, a privacy agreement, and you're collecting their data. And it may surprise you that on Facebook's page, when you go to I don't have a Facebook account and would like to request all my personal data stored by Facebook, it takes you to a form that says go to your Facebook page, and then on your account settings, you can download your data. So you're directing people that don't have access, don't even have a Facebook page, to have to sign up for a page to release their data. We've got to fix that.
Facebook misleading subscribers to hand over personal data. Facebook has been accused of purposely misleading their subscribers as they are shown the social network's updated terms and conditions in such a manner to accept GDPR or the General Data Protection Regulation from the European Union's privacy policy. Facebook's term and conditions appears to be pending notification from friends in the top right corner, such as unread messages and other alerts. The users have to agree there and then to hand over their personal data to see the waiting texts and notices, even though none may actually be waiting for them. That's just one of the claims against the company in a legal challenge that was filed in court. Under the European law, companies are required to gain consent before they're allowed to use individuals' personal data, a situation that requires Facebook and other tech giants into a difficult bind. The European law has no effect on users in North America other than get you to accept their terms and conditions. Facebook derives most of its income from gathering as much personal information about people
as possible and then packaging those records to be useful for advertisers. But in order to keep gathering that data, it had to get its millions of European users to explicitly agree to it. And Facebook is trying to use GDPR on North American users. Facebook has carefully designed its user interface to make it time-consuming for users to withhold their private information while repeatedly offering a single button to end the process and give it permission to continue scooping up their personal data. The company also gave lengthy and one-sided arguments for why users should continue to allow it and to gather and store their data. But the Silicon Valley giant took that misdirection one stage further when it placed red circles above the two icons at the top of the page that seemed to indicate that users have received new messages and notifications, and implied that you needed to agree to the new terms and conditions to see them. If a user hadn't agreed to Facebook's new terms, which include the continued gathering and storage of their personal data, the two dots appeared even when there weren't any messages or notifications. This approach, the lawsuit claims, violated GDPR since it's neither fair nor transparent. It also made it hard for subscribers to find the option to delete their account, which would have killed off the social network's access to the data by hiding the delete option in small text below a large colored button that led them back to the Facebook guided process. If you feel that Facebook tactics have been less than transparent or just absolutely there's a loss of confidence, then you should not hesitate to delete your account from Facebook.
Attackers can cause potentially harmful hard disk drive and operating system crashes by playing sounds over low-cost speakers embedded in computers or sold in stores. A team of researchers demonstrated this last week. The attacks use sonic and ultrasonic sounds to disrupt magnetic hard disk drives as they read or write data. The researchers showed how the technique could stop some video surveillance systems from recording live streams. Just 12 seconds of specially designed acoustic interference was all it took to cause video loss in a system, and sounds that lasted for 105 seconds or more caused the stock Western Digital 3.5-inch hard disk drive in the device to stop recording altogether until it was rebooted. The device uses flash storage to house its firmware, but by default it uses a magnetic hard disk drive to store the large quantities of video it records. The attack used a speaker hanging from a ceiling that rested about 4 inches above the surveillance system's hard disk drive. The researchers didn't remove the casing or otherwise tamper with the surveillance system. The likelihood of it happening is, I would say, probably rare, but it can happen if you happen to have a radio or other audio devices close to your operating system. This was a study that was done by University of Michigan as well as Zhejiang University. And I went through the abstract on this, which is about 6 pages, quite detailed, outlining how it's done. And so if you happen to have the blue screen of death happen because of a read error or write error, this is a possible cause, and just look at the acoustic environments that you're operating in. The problem poses a challenge for legacy magnetic disks that remain stubbornly common in safety-critical applications, such as medical devices and other highly utilized systems difficult to sunset. Magnetic hard disk drives is the common equipment that's being used on many devices. As we transition from hard disk drives to solid-state drives, this will probably be less of a potential problem, and this is something we can all look forward to.
Chrome users, beware! There are fake extensions in the Chrome store offering free movies that could cause you harm. If you see an extension offering films like Ready Player One or The Avengers, don't click on them. The promise of full access to high definition and 4K versions are false. Anybody following this trick will find themselves redirected to a site called Vios, or VIOOS.co, and it looks like a streaming page, but click on any of the videos on offer will take the user to another website called ZoomaStar. ZoomaStar then prompts you to create a free account that if you access, it will provide you with unlimited free movies. but this is just a scam to steal your data and infect your PC with malware. Another possibility is being taken from VIOS to etnamedia.net, which is blocked by Malwarebytes. Malwarebytes took action against the domain to halt suspected fraudulent practices. Users who found themselves on etnamedia.net reported charges to their credit cards without their knowledge or consent. It's best to only download Chrome extensions from trusted developers and always think twice about clicking on clicks that you're not familiar with.
The king is dead. Long live the king. Let's restate that. Windows XP is dead. Long live Windows XP in the military. Why the military can't quit Windows XP? The Pentagon's recent push to upgrade to Windows 10 won't leave all legacy Microsoft products behind. Well, when most organizations are deciding whether to upgrade their computers to the latest version of Microsoft Windows, they don't have to worry about life and death consequences. An exception to that rule is the U.S. Department of Defense, the nation's largest employer and a globe-spanning organization that must consider both cybersecurity risk and potentially fatal consequences related to computer failures when making the choice to abandon legacy operating systems such as Windows XP. The military's long-standing relationship with Windows XP is not unusual. Many PC users and companies clung to Windows XP long after its 2001 debut and refused to upgrade to follow up with newer Windows versions. In 2014, when Microsoft officials ended support for the aging operating system, Windows XP still accounted for 30% of operating systems worldwide. At the time, officials estimated that 3% of the Pentagon's several million computers were still running Windows XP. That same year, a Navy official issued a directive titled Windows XP Eradication Efforts. But the mission-critical functions of some of those computers can defy straightforward upgrades, which is why the Pentagon has often found it easier to, well, just give Microsoft multi-million dollars contract to continue to support specialized systems running on Windows XP. Oh, by the way, also Windows 2003 and other legacy Microsoft products. The downsides of legacy computing systems start to pile up as time goes on. Any legacy system will lag more behind the latest state-of-the-art computing to the point where you start to feel that it's being held together with chewing gum or duct tape. Military personnel may also find it more difficult to use older systems because of outdated or clunky interfaces. But the biggest risk for the U.S. military or any organization in relying on legacy systems is in cybersecurity. In early 2016, the Pentagon committed itself to the unprecedented move of upgrading computers across the entire organization to run on Microsoft Windows 10. The announcement came 8 months after a U.S. Navy contract asking for Microsoft support on the Windows XP and other legacy Microsoft products attracted a slew of new headlines such as U.S. Navy paid millions to stay on Windows XP. But even as the U.S. Department of Defense looks to complete the Windows 10 upgrade by the end of this year, it's still using some legacy Windows products, and not because of nostalgia. The challenges of upgrading military office computers that handle administrative tasks aren't that different from those facing any other large enterprises. And the U.S. Army alone upgraded 950,000 office IT computers to Windows 10 and became the first major military branch to completely upgrade to Windows 10, and this occurred January 2018. The U.S. Air Force targeted its upgrade for Windows 10 completion March 2018. Well, it's trying to. Whereas the Navy has said that it hopes to complete its Windows 10 push now in the summer of this year. You're dealing with a lot of machines that aren't contained in an office. They're floating all over the seas and in the air and all around the world. Unlike your average megacorporation, the Pentagon has to secure and update computer systems that support military operations and sometimes even directly control the navigation or weapons systems for tanks, warplanes, and warships. Those specialized computers are crucial for military operations on land, sea, and air. Some of the Windows boxes may help issue orders or communicate information about what's happening during both active battlefield firefights and ordinary operations such as a Navy warship on patrol. Others may directly integrate with weapons systems. Such Windows boxes are usually hosting specialized software packages and sometimes integrated with middleware clients. What might normally be a simple upgrade turns into a far more complex challenge of making sure that all the related software and computer systems can run smoothly with new Windows versions. So it's no surprise that the Pentagon's current Windows 10 upgrade plan seems focused on office computer systems rather than mission-critical systems. The Army just began to upgrade specialized systems related to industrial control systems, medical devices, and weapon systems, and has not yet scheduled any completion dates. Getting rid of XP once and for all will probably require attempts to re-engineer some military hardware and software so they're not as dependent upon specific operating systems, which could make future upgrades a lot easier. June 6, D-Day, the beginning of the end of World War II, and Marty Winston compares what those returning veterans came home to in terms of the technology in their houses, and how they found classic and clever answers to the kinds of things that today's home automation tries to accomplish.
Our cybernetic house does a lot of things that most houses don't even want to do, but if you think your house is normal, let's look back. This is June 6th, the anniversary of the 1944 Normandy landings that so significantly changed the course of World War II. It was still more than a year before the end of the war. That was September 2nd, 1945. Now, many of this program's listeners were born soon after those combatants returned home. But boomers, you were babies, and you may not remember what life was like in those early days, and you may not have considered how different our houses and homes are today. So let's take a look. Traditional media were the underpinnings of communication. There were newspapers, magazines, newsreels, and radio. Music was on the radio, or you might have a record player. Television didn't light up any screens until the late 40s, and its boom came in the 1950s. As forests of metal fishbone skeletons, the Yagi TV antenna adorned rooftops. Most telephones were still on party lines. You spun a dial to get a number. Maybe you went down the street to a payphone and dropped some coins in. There was no long distance except through an operator. Homes were heated with electricity or gas or coal or wood. Cooking happened the same way. Homes were cooled with open windows and fans. Food was cooled with blocks of ice delivered by a guy everybody knew as the Iceman. And until refrigerators became more commonplace, the cooling was done by placing those blocks of ice into an insulated cabinet called an icebox. There was a milkman, a butter and eggs man, a mailman who made two deliveries a day. Postage was a few pennies. Grocers weren't supermarkets, but would almost certainly deliver. Separate stores were bakeries and butcher shops. Lunch counters did not have drive-up windows. Transportation was by bus and streetcar. You'd see sets of encyclopedias at home, walls covered by chock-full bookshelves, almost everybody smoking, almost everywhere and anywhere. Science and technology were everywhere, and life was well advanced compared to what earlier generations had 50 or more years earlier. Electric power was widely available. Light bulbs were the most ubiquitous source of light. Everyone had a radio. The push lawnmower was so much handier than a scythe. And some people could afford electric hair dryers, clothes washers and dryers, maybe even refrigerators. It was still going to be a while before transistors or microwave ovens, but those also came, and so on and so on. I don't want to dwell on the past, but I do want to give some provenance for some home technology we all take for granted. If you wanted to automate your lighting, you'd buy a clockwork timer switch and plug your lamp into it. If you wanted to share photos with family and friends, you'd have the drugstore make some extra prints from your roll of film and you'd mail them. If you wanted an alert to go off whenever somebody approached your door, you'd get a dog. If you wanted to save on electricity while drying your bed sheets, you'd use a clothesline. To double-check your bank balance, you'd find your passbook. That's all, just find your passbook. Social media, hey, your choice. The back fence, the front yard, or the park. Too much or not enough heat in a room in the winter? Adjust the register vanes, or maybe add or remove a blanket. Too humid in the summer? A paper fan might help. There was nothing primitive about that era. We found ways to get done what we wanted to get done, and some of those ways were smarter than what we're doing today. So, okay, let's talk home automation. We had thermostats back then. Did you want to set a different temperature for when you got home? Either set it up before you go or wait until you get home, make the change, then wait a few minutes for it to catch up. And if you think your smart thermostat is a lot cleverer than that, remember this. The Russian hackers who are seizing control of today's smart thermostats and demanding ransomware would never be able to do that with what we had back then. Today, do you want to use a cloud-connected camera to keep an eye on the house when you're not home? It was easier back then because that was a time when fewer women worked, so more were able to keep an eye on their own homes as well as those of their neighbors. Now, today, let's say you're away and you're expecting somebody. So what will you do? You'd like to remote unlock your front door? Yeah, I know, that's an extremely foolish desire. But back then, letting somebody in was as easy as letting your trusted neighbors with copies of your house keys know that you're expecting somebody. Now, remember, all of those fighters who were in the field during World War II learned to have a very different perspective on life. They learned to take care of themselves and to watch out for each other. They learned about exchanges of trust. They learned that comfort wasn't even optional, that a roof is a luxury, hot food an indulgence, and that there were things more important than themselves. Dare I mention that they spoiled their kids and grandkids, and an escalation of that transited the generations in reverse, becoming an expectation of pampering that, if we're honest with ourselves, we all still share. Does it matter that vacuum tubes of those old times were replaced by transistors and then by microcircuits? Functionally, it may matter a little, but then as now, if there was something to accomplish, we found ways to accomplish it. Let's not get too cocky about having better tech, especially when so many of us use it so foolishly. So, my cybernetic house may seem like some kind of tech overkill adventure. In many ways, it deserves that. But the more you get to understand it, the more you may appreciate that it's not that far off from the things our returning veterans set out to do in their homes. Try to let most things take care of themselves. Try not to let things get to the point where fixing them will take major campaigns. Try not to sacrifice comfort or convenience, but at the same time, try to spend less on just having a place to live and covering the bills every month. That's not the same as those retail home automation products that I tend to hold in such low regard. You don't come home only to be forced to adjust everything by talking into a puck or a can on the table. When did you volunteer to be glued to your smartphone so you could be your home's puppeteer and pull all of its strings through a dozen different handset remote control apps? It's June. It's a time of year when you'll spend more time outdoors. And outdoors is the right place to think about whether or not you want to mess around with home automation gadgets. If you do, instead of thinking in terms of products, try thinking in terms of tasks. What is it you really want to get done? How important is it? If there wasn't a gizmo for it, would you want to do it at all or just skip it? All those many Junes ago, there wasn't much tech available. They still managed to figure out the weather. They still managed to keep a massive assault a secret. They still managed to push through opposition and get a job done. The job was a lot more important to them than being cold or wet or hungry or scared. So decide what's important to you, what enemies you want to attack. And like the Allies at Normandy, get those foes to back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty.
Marty's referring to the golden age of the boomer generation from 1946 to 1964. Life expectancy started with 64 years of age for males and 69 years for females in 1946. Today, the life expectancy in the United States for males is 79 years, and the life expectancy for females is 81. Life expectancy 100 years ago in 1917 was 48 for males and 54 for females. If you look at the glass of water as half empty, you'll be stuck in the twilight zone. And if you're looking at the glass as half full, you'll be able to appreciate life cultural transitions. The oldest person ever lived reached 122. Hey, me? I'm shooting for 150. Technology today with the microprocessor has expanded from personal computing to the Internet of Things. With its convergence with communications, we can have the personal portable television and personal portable telephone in your pocket. We can carry with us the encyclopedia of knowledge packed with updated information in the size of a credit card. We can globally browse and shop for the best prices in the comforts of our home. Although it is in its infancy, the autonomous car that can almost drive itself is here. The computer in all its platform variations have been an agent of change. It has disrupted politics and the status quo in marketing and social norms. We have cleaner water and cleaner air, and today we are more environmental conscious. This got me thinking about the past and the future. Marty Winston has a special project of building a maintenance-free 40-year-old home. The challenge I give him is to renovate and enable three homes originally built in 1977 to be maintenance-free. The challenge is you must use what material exists in each home. You cannot introduce any new build materials. Another challenge is you can only use what tools existed in each home. One more challenge, you cannot physically visit the home to do the work. In the real world, however, you can use new tools and materials to renovate the home. Of course you need to and will have access to the physical structure. Being the gadfly that I am, I took the retro perspective of how many programmers are willing to support a project with three computer systems, each 40 years old. About 40 years ago, there was the twin launch of Voyager 1 and 2. Although the event was 1977, the satellite design was based on existing technology that predated the launch. Voyagers 1 and 2 were each equipped with three different computers. They're still being maintained and used and are operational and communicating outside the solar system, transmitting back to home Earth. One day, some alien civilization far off will find them in another galaxy and wonder, how low-tech can Earth be? Also note that most spacecraft use many CPUs, either for redundancy or for split tasks. Being able to separately control each component of a spacecraft is very important. This would be impossible if one CPU controlled them all. With each subsystem powered by its own CPU subsystem, it can be better controlled for power management and fault tolerance. Viking Orbiter had installed a General Electric 18-bit transistor-to-transistor logic machine with a bit serial single-register accumulator and a bit serial access to plated wire RAM with 4K words. It executed 25,000 instructions per second. The Viking Lander computers was a Honeywell HDC-402 of a different design with 18K of 24-bit words with plated wire RAM. And the third computer used in the flight data subsystems in both was a new custom design in CMOS with 128-register Nibble serial CPU, 8K words of 16-bit RAM, and it ran about 80,000 instructions per second. Of course, the speed of these three machines is much, much slower than what's available in a smartphone today. Voyager 1 was launched in September 1977. On August the 25th, 2012, it entered into interstellar space and is still active. Voyager 1 flew past Jupiter in 1979, past Saturn in 1980, making special close approach to Saturn's moon Titan. The probe passed the heliopause on the 25th of August, 2012, to enter interstellar space, and it's still very active. Voyager used the same computer as the Viking orbiter in only one of its three computerized subsystems. The third computer used in the flight data subsystem was a new custom design in CMOS with 128 register, nibble serial CPU, and 8K words of 16-bit RAM. All its processing speed was 80,000 instructions per second. Gee, you know, your smartphone carries much more power today, and look at what these three primitive computers back in 1977 were asked to do. 40 years later, they're still working very productively. Public service announcements of scheduled computer club meetings in the Tri-State Northeast region. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on The Secret History of Silicon Valley, Thursday, June 7th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor of White Plains, New York. Long Island Mac Users Group will have a presentation on What Happened at Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference, Friday, June 8th. Meeting time 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology at Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherr Hall. New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Excel versus Google Sheets. Thursday, June 14th, meeting time is 7 p.m. at the NYU Silver Building, room 405, in Manhattan, New York. Princeton PC Users Group will have a presentation on What's a Router and Why Do You Want One? Tuesday, June the 26th, meeting time is 7 p.m., Mercer County Library, Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will actually have the same presentation, What's a Router and Why Do I Want One? Thursday, June 28th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their main meeting on Friday, July the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartow Avenue, that's 1916 Bartow Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have their meeting on Tuesday, July 3rd, meeting time is 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. All these computer club meetings are free and open to the public, and we hope to see you at the meetings. And if you've never been to a computer club meeting, you should attend one. If you have any technical questions, you'll get answers there because they are random access sessions, and there's no such thing as a dumb computer question. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or www.wbai.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key. On behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.